From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My fellow Americans, today our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces responsible for the brutality in Kosovo. We have acted with resolve for several reasons. We act to protect thousands of innocent people in Kosovo from a mounting military offensive. We act to prevent a wider war, to defuse a powder keg at the heart of Europe. By acting now, we are upholding our values, protecting our interests, and advancing the cause of peace.
That was then U.S. President Bill Clinton on March 24, 1999, 16 years ago this Tuesday, as he announced the beginning of what was characterized as a humanitarian bombing campaign against Yugoslavia over the breakaway province of Kosovo. The U.S.-led NATO bombing campaign killed hundreds of civilians and destroyed apartment buildings, farms, schools, hospitals, and churches, even hitting the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, killing three Chinese journalists and injuring about 20 additional Chinese nationals. Between March 24, 1999 and June 10th of that year, NATO aircraft flew over 38,000 combat missions against Yugoslavia, mostly concentrated on the capital Belgrade and on Kosovo, the flashpoint of the conflict. Using fighter jets as well as long-range cruise missiles from warships in the Adriatic Sea, NATO destroyed vital strategic infrastructure, including bridges, government buildings, and factories. The NATO campaign also targeted critical civilian infrastructure, including power plants and water processing facilities, causing substantial environmental and economic damage to the country. NATO's bombing also resulted in the death of at least hundreds of civilians, with Serbian sources reporting more than 2,000 civilians and 1,000 service personnel killed, more than 5,000 people wounded, and over 1,000 missing. On Tuesday, a pair of non-governmental organizations in Serbia said NATO should pay compensation for the massive damage inflicted during the campaign. The Belgrade Forum for a World of Equals and the Club of Generals and Admirals in Belgrade presented an initiative to hold 28-member NATO financially accountable for the damage that Serbia sustained in the attacks. According to a report in the Russian news agency TASS, retired General Jovo Milanovic said that NATO's military offensive, which was not sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council, represented, quote, a violation of all norms of international law and caused enormous material damage to Yugoslavia with huge human casualties, closed quote. Serbian experts put the price tag of the devastation between 60 and 100 billion U.S. dollars. The war on Yugoslavia represented the first test application of the U.S.'s integrated regime change strategy, which apparently still holds sway in Washington, fielding a combination of tactics that would be further developed and perfected in later conflicts in such places as Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Ukraine. We'll take a closer look at the U.S. intervention in Yugoslavia and how it relates to those conflicts later this week. Israel has been accused of spying on the U.S. delegation to the P5+1 talks with Iran over the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
U.S. media reports that Israel spied on closed-door talks over Iran's nuclear program involving the five members of the U.N. Security Council and Germany as part of efforts to build a case against a potential deal. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Israeli espionage efforts included eavesdropping as well as acquiring information from confidential U.S. briefings, informants, and diplomatic contacts in Europe. The journal has cited U.S. officials as saying that the spy operation was part of a campaign by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They say Netanyahu attempted to undercut support for a deal by sharing the gleaned information with U.S. lawmakers and others. Israeli officials have denied spying directly on U.S. negotiators. The revelation comes against the background of President Barack Obama's already difficult relationship with Netanyahu. To discuss that further, and I joined Mr. E. Michael Jones, who is the editor of Culture Wars Online magazine, and he's joining us live now via Skype from Indiana. Mr. Jones, how do you see this rift and then these accusations of spying on these talks?
Well, it's just part of the ongoing fallout of this split over America's foreign policy, a kind of historic split that's opening up right now. between the Democrats and the Republicans over support for Israel. Israel had bipartisan support before this campaign, but Netanyahu's recklessness here in spying, in manipulating the Congress, in passing confidential information on, has turned it into a partisan issue, which I think is Israel's worst nightmare. So the what we're going to see now is the Obama administration pushing back. I think that's already happened at the J Street conference, which is the liberal Israel lobby. Dennis McDonough, who's a spokesman for the Obama administration, reaffirmed the Obama administration's commitment to a two-state solution. I think we're going to see more things like leaks, like Zabig Brzezinski saying if Israel flies over Iraq, Obama should shoot down their planes if they're planning to attack Iran. I think we're going to see more of this as the Netanyahu's recklessness creates more pushback from the Obama administration.
And just briefly, if you can, Mr. Jones, certainly there is that Israel lobby factor here, isn't there? How far really can the Obama administration go?
Well, they've got more leeway now because there are two Israel lobbies now. There's IPAC, which is the traditional Likudnik hardline Israel lobby, but now there's J Street, which is the liberal Israel lobby. And I think that this gives this differential gives the Obama administration much more leverage in dealing with Netanyahu than any administration had before. Certainly back to the time of George Bush the first, when James Baker tried to rein in the Israelis, he didn't have this tool available to him. So I think there's more leverage now that the Obama administration can make use of.
According to the New York Times, late Tuesday, three top Israeli ministers denied that Israel spied on the closed-door talks. Emergency talks over Greece's debt once again brought no results, except for another warning from EU leaders who want Athens to present a comprehensive list of economic reforms to satisfy lenders' demands. For more on this, we have Press TV's Konstantin Venizalos reporting from Athens.
No coherent, cohesive, substantial statements were made as regards to whether Greece will exit the Eurozone, what is the financial reality in Greece. If the plan of Germany is to push Greece into a disorderly default before the Spanish elections in September, this evening it seemed as though it failed, but it hasn't. This agenda is still at play in the background. If, on the other hand, Mr. Tsipras' plan was to use the issue of war reparations as a desperate bargaining chip, again, that was the wrong moment to mention it. Having said all this, it's evident that Mr. Tsipras is trying to gain some time. It's very important in European politics that a party like Syriza wins the national elections in Spain. If we had another Syriza in Spain, then the pressure against European officials and leaders would have been dramatically increased. So we see the Prime Minister trying to gain some time without committing himself to anything specific. Mr. Tsipras made no mention of what exactly the Greek proposals for reforms are all about. And Mrs. Merkel, of course, very carefully avoided any confrontational attitude either towards the Eurogroup partners or Greece as a partner in the Eurozone and the European Union.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov arrived in Cuba Tuesday to discuss a wide range of international and regional issues, as well as bilateral trade and economic cooperation initiatives. The Russian Foreign Minister was also set to meet with President Raul Castro later in the day. Lavrov's visit to Cuba marks the start of a tour of four Latin American nations, including Colombia and Nicaragua, with his trip concluding in Guatemala later in the week. The U.S. has assured the Afghan president it will keep funding the country's military for at least two more years. Despite significant security challenges, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Afghanistan's development has shown signs of progress.
There is good news in Afghanistan. Life expectancy has risen by 20 years. Healthcare access has increased dramatically. The number of children in school has risen from some 900,000 who were just boys to 8 million now, with 40% of them girls. The overall economy has been growing, and the combined security forces are now larger and more capable.
For more, we go to RT's Rory Suchet, who laid out some of the details of the deal between the two countries Tuesday.
American funding is expected to maintain the state's 352,000-strong security forces through the end of 2017. According to the Obama administration officials, that could mean around $4 billion this year and nearly the same amount for next year as well. Now, Washington is insisting that the money is needed to provide security and stability and to promote prosperity. But while trumpeting Afghanistan's progress, the realities on the ground seem to be telling a bit of a different story. According to the United Nations, more than 10,000 civilians were either killed or injured last year alone in the country, which is still plagued by Taliban attacks. That's an increase of more than 20% from 2013 and is the highest casualty toll in 5 years.
This year, we'll see the 13th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and the official beginning of what the U.S. has called the War on Terror. Although at the time of the 2001 invasion, the main terrorist group targeted by the U.S. was Al-Qaeda, whose domain was limited in scope to the remote mountain areas of Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan. After 13 years of fighting, hundreds of thousands of dead and wounded civilians, and, by some estimates, more than $1 trillion spent, Al-Qaeda and newer terrorist groups like the Islamic State and Al-Nusra Front now control large portions of Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, and terrorist attacks are common in places like Nigeria on an almost daily basis. We discussed this apparent failure of U.S. strategy with journalist and political commentator Sukant Chandan from London via Skype Tuesday. Do you want to maybe give people a little context for this, the rise of these terrorist groups, where they came from, how they were funded, what purpose they served, the whole bit? You want to kind of lay it out for us?
Sure, brother. I think just anecdotally, first of all, I think the growing sentiment, and perhaps I can even call it the growing mass sentiment, throughout the what's known as the Muslim world, that's, I suppose, countries where the majority of the people are Muslim, the growing sentiment is that these terrorists or death squads are not strategically adversely impacting the white colonial settler state of so-called Israel, and they're not adversely impacting Western hegemony and militarism, etc. But actually they're facilitating the strategic interests and goals of the Zionist state and of their senior backers and colleagues in London, Paris, and Washington. So that's anecdotal, but I think it's important to also consider the mass sentiment out there, because this is how history works. History works by people not being aware of the machinations behind closed doors of the military intelligence services and the states of the greatest powers, or as Dr. King said, the greatest purveyors of violence on the planet today, which he said was his own government, and I would probably add in the other leading NATO powers. So people are seeing, even those who might have perhaps sympathized with the broad kind of movements that we can call under the banner of Al-Qaeda, but I include the wrongly named Islamic State in that as well. But, you know, people even who might have sympathized with them as some kind of distorted and perverse response to Western oppression and invasion and aggression, well, they're seeing that these are not the standard bearers and the banner holders of any kind of Islamically informed liberation movement for their own people, but they are just traumatizing and destroying everything. And they're doing so, and the results of which are exactly what the West and their local allies in Israel, the Gulf monarchies, and the Turkish state have been planning for many, many years, if not decades, if not a few generations. So that's the anecdotal kind of appraisal of the situation. But a more scientific appraisal, and it's difficult to be scientific in regards to this, because we're dealing with covert operations, which are secret operations. So it's just very little information and evidence that we have. A lot of it's circumstantial, but there's some very blatant things, like Hakim Belhaj, who's the death squad leader in Libya, was the open ally, the leading NATO, a Libyan NATO ally, who led NATO's alliance with the military council, which Hakim Belhaj, which now sections of the Western mainstream are saying he's the leader of so-called ISIS in Libya. And there's many other things, but perhaps, you know, that'll come out more in our conversation.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, materially, you're seeing overt actions on the ground, such as Israel treating medically ISIS, Al-Nusra fighters, and those fighters getting their arms from Saudi Arabia. So, the fact of an alliance behind some of these fighters between Israel and some of the Muslim states is it's being openly discussed even in the Western media because it's so obvious.
Exactly, Brother Don. I mean, I think that's very important to highlight that the United Nations has lodged a formal complaint complaining that why is the Zionist state supporting and giving direct assistance and open assistance on the border with Syria, on the Golan. So that is an example of concrete evidence by which we have the Zionist state teaming up openly with these death squads. I mean, you and I knew this for many years, but obviously people outside our camp and who are perhaps a little bit cynical and skeptical about our politics sometimes can only be convinced, sometimes they can't even be convinced by this, but more people can be convinced that if the United Nations makes a formal complaint that this is happening, we saw the pictures before, and also you don't need to see any of this, you just need to see that the fact that the Zionist state's Air Force has conducted something up to 5 or 6 air sorties against Syria in the last 3 years, all of which has targeted not the death squads of Nusra and al-Sham and Islamic Front and so-called ISIS, but has targeted the Syrian government and its primary allies in Lebanese Hezbollah and the Iranian Islamic Republic. The other circumstantial evidence is that the Turkish state has been facilitating tens of thousands, and this is documented by the Western mainstream, that the Western mainstream has documented the Turkish state under the AKP and Erdogan has facilitated tens of thousands of death squads into Syria through Turkish territory. What the Western mainstream doesn't tell you is that the Turkish state is a primary ally of Washington and London in this phony war on terror, which I always say is not a war on terror. It's a war of neo-colonial terrorism against the people of the global south, particularly targeted at Muslims.
Right.
So this is some of the, I think the evidence is overwhelming, be it direct, open evidence or circumstantial. But it's obviously, when you say these things to Eurocentric people and Westerners, what we're saying to them is challenging and breaking down their whole world view. Right. On an ethical and cultural level. You're saying to them that your government is not fighting terrorism. It's actually developing terrorism. It's not, when Joe Biden went to Turkey just a few months ago and blamed all his primary allies in the region for creating ISIS.
Right.
The expression is you point one finger at someone and four fingers are pointed back at you.
That's right.
And that's quite the point with Joe Biden. Why is he going around, blaming everyone else for the mess that he and his colleagues are primarily have made? As I said to Mr. Korb, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, if I'm not mistaken, on a TV discussion last night, to which Mr. Korb got very upset and shouted at me several times,
I think
pointing to his guilt complex. When I said to Mr. Korb, if you're serious about the U.S. government fighting terrorism, so why doesn't the U.S. sanction its primary allies, who are the mainstays of these death squads? That's the Turkish state, the Gulf monarchies, and the Pakistani military intelligence, or the Pakistani ISI. And then the colleague who was hosting the show, Sister Marzia Hashmi, on Press TV, she added in to Mr. Korb as well. She said, why don't you put any pressure on your primary allies, who is developing this death squad terrorism, like you've done against Russia.
Right.
Remember, the West has accused Russia, in my opinion, probably your opinion, wrongly of developing terrorism. No, they're supporting people in Ukraine against a Western-induced coup against the Ukrainian people. But the United States government has put all kinds of financial sanctions on Russia. Why not the same sanctions on Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia, as it stands for institutionally and conceptually, is no different. It's exactly the same as the death squad known as ISIS or Daesh, etc. So this is just a phony, manipulative, deceitful war on terror by the neo-colonialists.
Yeah, and not only are the Saudis and the Qataris and directly sponsoring financially, and Jordan and Turkey allowing the training and the basing and the safe harboring of all of these terrorists, But you have also the actual occupation of Bahrain, for example, by the Saudis against the popular uprising.
No, absolutely. I mean, if I think all that it takes is if people are a bit more self-critical, and we all make mistakes. You and I, I'm sure, have made many political mistakes. I made many political mistakes in the recent past. I thought the Arab Spring was a great thing that would perhaps help liberate and raise the conditions of the people in which the Arab Spring impacted. well, what turned out to be the case, the opposite is true, that it's collapsed societies and it's facilitated all, you know, the colonial matrix of power oppressions, be it misogyny, you know, ethnic tensions, religious tensions, and conflict, etc. So we get things wrong, but I think people need to employ some self-criticism and I think work backwards from understanding the resistant victims and seeing their plight and seeing what they're saying and working backwards from that. Because there's no point asking the greatest purveyors of violence on the planet today, as Dr. King says, the most oppressive entities on the planet, because they're not going to tell you the truth. They have a vested interest in hiding the truth from us and maintaining and expanding their attempts at monopolizing cultural and military and economic and diplomatic power across the planet. And this, and you know, if the radical left could do more in West Europe and North America, which it's not doing, unfortunately, a lot of the left is implicated in this Western state strategies in the war on terrorism, i.e. they're defending death squads as some kind of human rights campaign. But if the left could, like the people of Spain did after the attacks in Madrid in 2004, the Al-Qaeda death squads conducted an attack on the train system in Madrid. After the Madrid terrorist action happened, the Spanish government immediately blamed ETA for that. The Spanish people understood that the Spanish government is scapegoating and diverting the reality of the situation. And there was mass protests in the streets against, not against Muslims, not against the Syrian government, but against the Spanish government's own deceit and manipulation. And the result of that, the whole Spanish army was withdrawn from, I think it was Afghanistan or Iraq, or perhaps both. I can't remember the top of my head. And why can't the anti-war movement in Britain and the United States and other places in the so-called West employ the same strategy? They can't, because a lot of them, and there's some good people in the anti-war leadership as well. I can't say they're all bad, because I work with them. There's some good people there who are trying to advocate exactly what I'm suggesting. Unfortunately, you know, wide sections of the Western liberal and left are either fooled by this deceit or and a combination of promoting neo-colonial prejudices, which is feeding exactly the problems that we're facing.
Yeah, one of the big problems in the United States is the persistence of white supremacy, and even its adoption by vast sectors of the African American population here with the election of a black president. You know, we're all Americans now, and what we're doing there in Libya and other places in Africa must be right without doing any real analysis.
No, quite. I think you've hit upon a quite important and profound issue here, which is that in this period, I think post 1999 roughly, that the whole Western system is an existentialist crisis when faced with the growing capacity and unity of the global South, that it's seeking certain mechanisms to increase its longevity and its hegemonic position on the planet. And it's primarily doing so by basically the strategy of blackface, incorporating non-white people to give the neo-colonial white supremacist nature of the system a brown or black face. It's the Obama strategy. It's, you know, put an African of some partial Muslim heritage as the head representative of your system, and then you can more easily bomb Africa and destroy a resistant leading vanguard African state, which was Libya in 2011, and they did that very successfully, it has to be said. And you can also continue to do that against Syria, and also you can start a war against China, which is the pivot to Asia, quote unquote. So yeah, you know, you're absolutely right that unfortunately, and this is profoundly manifest actually in the death squad such as Nusra and so-called ISIS as well, that here you have black and Asian people adopting the same depraved model of neocolonialism and white supremacy, of the big neocolonial white supremacists. So ISIS and Nusra are only but the asymmetric mirror reflection of white supremacy and of Zionism. And Zionism is another kind of internalization and projection of white supremacy itself in Jewish garb, as ISIS is in false Islamic garb. So what is the Zionist and what are ISIS saying, which is exactly the same? Just as white supremacy, they're saying, we are not only the representatives of God, God. We are actually gods. We are making God's decision on who are God's chosen people and who are not God's chosen people. And those who are outside of God's chosen people, or the people that we define as legitimate people, those outside of that, as Frantz Fanon said, those people who are put outside of the zone of being are then subjected to total dehumanization and total eradication. So when the biggest colonialists, the Brits and the French and the Yanks, wiped out whole populations, 4 million in three years in Korea, which Mr. Korb got very upset about when I mentioned that. He probably has some personal experience in relation to the war of aggression against Korea. When the West, you know, killed 3 million people in Vietnam throughout the 60s and 70s, similarly, the Zionist state wipes out thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese and Syrians before, and Egyptians before, and Jordanians before. You know, they wipe them out in a few weeks. And ISIS and Nusra and these death squads are systematically wiping out any Sunni Muslims who don't agree with their death squad project or they have spats with them. They conceptually have defined Shia, Yazidi, Kurds, Christians, Druze, and other minorities who hitherto lived in peace and mutual respect under the Syrian Ba'athist government. But now they are systematically wiping them out in principle. It's not just a spat that they have between militias. In principle, that's what they're setting out to do. So no, you're absolutely correct that unfortunately too many of our people are falling for this white supremacist strategy of internalization and projecting and then doing the dirty work of the biggest neocolonial white supremacists. And isn't it a beautiful thing for the West that they don't have to commit any of their even working class white people, because black and Asian people are doing that dirty work much more effectively for them? It's a really very tragic and sad situation.
You know, and on that point, one of the things that you pointed out that also sent Korb off the rails, because he was like, don't talk about those other places, just talk about Syria, was when you pointed back to the creation of these colonial minority governments and forces on the ground, back to, for example, Brzezinski in 1979 in Afghanistan, and the colonial governments themselves, for example, in Iraq and other places, where you had a minority sect that was in charge, and it created antagonisms inside the society.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mr. Korb and his colleagues are in the business of deceit and manipulation and lies. Because you can't go around telling the people of the world, yeah, actually, we're just, you know, developing terrorism and collapsing your societies because we need to dominate. And if we don't dominate, we're not going to allow China and Russia to have any functional relationship with you guys. We have a scorched earth policy. That type of narrative doesn't really wash with people. Because it's honest, but it doesn't wash with people because, you know, people will more quickly, in greater numbers, realize the whole scam and the whole mafia operation for what it is. No. Ever since actually the turn of the 20th century, and actually the Russian revolutionary Lenin put it way back around the time of the First World War, he said very, very, very clearly and simply, he said, the democratic shell is the best system of governance for imperialism because they can operate more cleanly and without being identified as being criminal. And developing that, the whole Western white supremacist neocolonial system, when it was trying to colonize the minds of the people of Africa, Asia, and so-called Latin America, they had to kind of, for example, the Anglican Church in Africa, they couldn't just come about with English colonial racist recruiting, you know, people in Africa. They had to Africanize the colonial Anglican Church. They had to put blackface. They had to compromise a tiny bit, not to change the colonial nature of their project, the neocolonial system. And we know we have black and Asian non-white governors of states of the United States, including black and Asian ministers in Britain as well. And what is the soundtrack? Literally, what's the soundtrack of U.S. imperialism across the world? It's Jay-Z. It's Rihanna.
Right. That's right.
It's, you know, it's non-white people, black people. Who are helping in the perpetuation and the longevity of this absolutely moribund, decadent system of neocolonialism.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.